Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh, and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist, nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing the roles, lives, and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 16, Sunday, May the 18th, 2008. Astronomy, a cultural perspective. You can't think of Darwin without Wallace, Laurel without Hardy, and in the UK there is no more an enduring and familiar partnership in astronomy than Hendest and Cooper. Nigel and Heather have been writing, broadcasting, supporting and publicising astronomy for decades. Their most recent project is a series of daily radio programmes for BBC Radio 4 called Cosmic Quest, and a book which charts the story of how human societies through history around the globe have attempted to understand the universe and their place within it. Heather talks about the radio series, but first, Nigel Hendest, a co-author of the associated book, History of Astronomy. I discovered he was born in my adopted home, Manchester.
I was born in Manchester, yes. My father was a professor of chemistry at the university, so I was brought up for my early years in West Didsbury. I'm afraid I moved out when I was only 3 or 4 years old, so my memories are fairly vague.
So you will have missed out on the fun of the Red Line in West Didsbury, which is very well known.
Next time I'm back, I shall definitely follow up that one then.
I'll buy your point.
Right.
Tell us about Hen Coop.
When I went to uni, which is University of Leicester, I met up with Heather Cooper. We were both doing the astrophysics course, and I really felt I was a year ahead of her. They were named like Hendest and Cooper. We actually had to do business together in some way or other. We had to be Hen Coop. And Heather's name is spelled C-O-U-P-E-R. So we are Hen Coop with a U in it. And we have Hen Coop Enterprises.
And how long have you known Heather now?
Well, since we were undergraduates, so she then went on to Oxford to do research on clusters of galaxies, the biggest things in the universe, and I went to Cambridge and I worked on quasars, so the most powerful things in the universe. But we then both realised that we wanted to move sideways from pure research, where you learn more and more about less and less, really tell people about the excitement of astronomy. Well, there are very few people doing it at the time. Patrick Moore, bless him, was doing it then, he still is and does a fantastic job, but there's so many exciting results to convey.
Well, I certainly have been brought up on Patrick Moore, Heather Cooper and yourself, so thank you very much for that. You've written about 36 books?
I think that's what it was at the last count, yes. The latest book which Heather and I have done is called The History of Astronomy, what it is and what it says on the cover. To be fair, we actually wanted to have a more exciting title, like From Babylon to the Big Bang or Cosmic Quest or something like that, where the publishers in their infinite wisdom decided that The History of Astronomy is what it is. So we spent about a year researching not just the obvious figures like Galileo and Newton and Einstein, but going behind the scenes and coming up with some figures who are less well-known but all part of history. And also not just following the Western culture from the Greeks onwards, but going around the world to China, to the Aboriginal people of Australia, the Polynesians who use the stars to navigate across the Pacific, and see how different people can have different views of the same sky.
So why history of astronomy, Nigel?
It's something that I haven't written about before. I mean, I've done books on the new astronomy, seeing things in new wavelengths, about the planet Mars, about galaxies, stars, and so on. Always in the back of my mind, I've been intrigued by the history of astronomy, why people came to believe that the Earth goes around the Sun rather than the Sun goes around the Earth. It's an obvious question, because the Earth seems so solid. How did people come to that point of view? And then when I've travelled, I go to China, you see the different ways in which people looked at the sky there. So it's always been inside me wanting to get out, because astronomy isn't just about current 21st century ideas of what's up there in the sky and why it's there. It's the story of how we came to understand the heavens, which for me that's the second dimension, which is equally...
For some reason, if you look back to the last decade or so, history culturally seems to have a higher profile.
Yes, these things come and go in fashion, especially on television. Well, cookery is always there, I suppose. But see, we had a lot of astronomy. If you go back to the 80s, Halley's Comet and so on, we had a lot of astronomy, and astronomy just dropped out of the 1990s. You just didn't see it at all. Mm-hmm. And now I'm glad to see it making a bit of a resurgence again.
What's Cosmic Quest, and is this book part of it?
Cosmic Quest is a series on Radio 4, which is coming out starting on May 26th. Being presented by Heather, and it's on the history of astronomy, so it parallels the book. A series on the history of music, a series on the history of medicine, and they searched astronomy as being the next title, but because Heather was a co-author of the book with me, it's natural for her to be the presenter of it. So there are 15-minute programmes coming out at 3:45 each weekday, and then on Friday evenings there's going to be a roundup programme of what's been broadcast that week as well.
All the book and the radio programme, you must have covered some air miles.
Yes, we did two major trips. One was to Europe. It was a time when the International Astronomical Union was meeting in Prague.
Oh, yes.
And it was a meeting where they demoted Pluto. I mean, when you think about the entire history of astronomy, we've discovered new planets. We've never demoted a planet before. So that had to be done. And Prague was where Kepler did most of his major work.
Yeah.
We then went to Poland to go to Fromburg, which was a huge trek. You have to fly into Gdansk and then drive for 2 hours. This is the little town on the border with Russia now, where Copernicus lived and worked. And the fortified cathedral where he did his work for 30, 40 years is still there. The tower, Copernicus's tower, is still there. And you can go around as a museum now. So that was one of the high spots of the trip.
Nigel Headbest, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Heather Cooper, well-known broadcaster and author. You've been associated with science and astronomy since the 1970s. And I should say since 2007. It's Heather Cooper, CBE. Congratulations and welcome to AstroTalk UK.
Oh, thank you very much, Kavir. That's fantastic. Yes, I mean, the CBE was a complete and utter bolt from the blue, you should say. I didn't expect to get it. I got it for services to science. A lot of it because I was working as one of the 9 Millennium Commissioners. Our role was to put lottery money into big capital projects. And I was the only person on the Millennium Commission, which included people like Michael Heseltine, with a knowledge of science. So every time I had an opportunity, because we couldn't commission projects, but people could suggest projects from the outside, every time there came a possibility of commissioning a science centre, I said, yes, let's go for it. We checked the business plans out. And in the end, we got literally £500 million worth of science and environmental centres, including the Eden Project, the National Space Centre at Leicester, and the Genetics Project at Newcastle.
Well, £500 million, that's astonishing. Well done.
Thank you.
Now, before we talk about one of your newer projects, I was listening recently to one of your previous ones where you went out to Sri Lanka and interviewed Arthur C. Clarke. Arthur C. Clarke, of course, is well known for his science fiction, but he was an accomplished scientist as well. How did his work influence yours?
Oddly enough, it didn't. What influenced me much more was his friendship. I'm not a great science fiction fan. My hobbies are, the English countryside, huge, deep interest in classical music, and I'm fascinated by church architecture, even though I'm not a believer in God. But Arthur actually befriended me. He actually sought me out, which I thought was very, very charming. And that's what led to my trips to Sri Lanka. And I was fascinated by his vision. I did a TV program with him for Discovery about 10 years ago. And then I got to meet his family, which was charming. He came over for his, I think it was his 75th birthday, and he came over to Minehead, where he was born, near Minehead. Apparently Patrick Moore was due to chair a panel, or a panel of just Arthur and Gentry Lee, the science fiction writer and scientist. Patrick got hit in the eye by a cricket ball, and I had a phone call from my friend Matt Irvin, who invented K9 on Doctor Who. And he said, Heather, would you like to meet Arthur? So I went over to Minehead with two of my friends. I chaired the session. I met the whole Clark family. And they were just lovely to me. Fred, his brother, is adorable. The last visit I made was about a year and a half ago. Angie, his niece, said, look, it's the 60th anniversary of the geostationary orbit, which Arthur had predicted, where you could have a satellite hovering over the Earth, and if you had three, you could actually have whole Earth coverage of communications or meteorological observations. So I went over, and I and my favourite producer, Martin Redfern, did a programme about Arthur in the Archives Hour for BBC Radio 4, where we talked about Arthur's contributions to this you know, incredible breakthrough in telecommunications. And, you know, he was a visionary. He was an amazing man. And one question I remember asking him was, well, you know, what's going to happen in the future? Our robot, is machinery going to take over? And he said, if we let machinery take over, we will cease to be human.
Along with Arthur, as Isaac Asimov, Carl Sagan, Arthur successfully advanced science by skillfully combining it with fiction. Do we have such figures like that around now? And
do we we do. I will say that absolutely emphatically. My hero and one of my dearest friends is Stephen Baxter, who was collaborating with Arthur on some of his science fiction. Stephen is basically a physics graduate. He was a physics teacher. He's based in England and the most wonderful, modest person I've ever met. He's hugely knowledgeable, and I think if there's anybody who's going to take on the mantle of Arthur, it's Stephen Baxter, who will combine both the science and the science fiction.
Moving on to Cosmic Quest. It's a series of radio programs on Radio 4, daily, 5 days a week, for 6 weeks. What's the central theme of Cosmic Quest?
It's a reflection of our culture. It's basically how the heavens has driven humankind to think, to explore. It's something that has, if you like, inspired our ideas and our ideals. Why else would you call the sky heaven? And why else would you populate it with deities like the old deities, Jupiter, Venus, Mars, Saturn? And why else is a nod towards astrology, which of course I totally disapprove of? The Chinese believe that if there was any change in the heavens, it represented some insurrection in their provinces. Showing how humans are linked with the sky and how in the past we were much more linked with the sky than we are today. And then the other thing, of course, they did with the sky, because it was something above them which they could use. They would use it for timekeeping and navigation.
Are you disappointed that despite the enlightenment from science that there are still so many people around the world who still, through astrology or other things, still have a false assessment of the sky?
I'm very, very disappointed by astrology. There is no evidence for it whatsoever. I would like people to realise the real link between humans and the universe. We are part of the stars ourselves. We are actually stardust. We're actually made of stuff that has come from the stars. I mean, when you look at the gold in your wedding ring, or the silver in your engagement ring, and look at the carbon in your bodies, all you have to do is to say, where did that come from? And the answer is, it came from ejections of matter from dying stars. You and I are actually made of that, and that's our true connection with the stars.
Through Cosmic Quest, as many more people will come to that recognition, one of the, I think, goals you had been there was understanding the universe itself and our place within it. That's a huge undertaking. Was it a scary one when the idea for Cosmic Quest was first suggested?
I must admit that looking to our part in the universe and our place within it was totally scary. But fortunately, I and my colleague Nigel Henbest had written a book on the history of astronomy. It just came to me one day. It was quite bizarre. My publisher said to me, "Heather, what would you like to work for us on next?" And I was musing, and I said, "I think what I'd like to do is the definitive illustrated history of astronomy." And he said, "If I could write a commissioning form on this serviette, I would do it now." I thought, oh my goodness. And that's what drove the book. And we realized that the book was not so much a book about science or the development of science, but the development of our culture. We went to Fromburg in Poland, where Nicholas Copernicus was the canon of the cathedral. We went to Prague. We went to Tycho Brahe's island, Levine, which I hadn't been to before. And then we learnt from... It was scary, yeah, very. But on the other hand, it was absolutely amazing to think the Aborigines, who I reckon are the first race and the first continuous race to observe the heavens. You know, it's just unbelievable that a small race of human beings have actually managed to understand the universe as brilliantly as it has. And that's why, you know, I'm so proud to do the series. I think I became less scared as the series went on.
You did travel beyond Europe, and you mentioned the Aborigines in Australia. Were there any places that you really wanted to visit but weren't able to?
The place I did want to visit was India. There is an amazing observatory, not with telescopes, but with measuring instruments, rather like Tycho Brahe's in Jaipur. I would love to have gone there. Also, although I mention it in the series, I'd love to have gone to see some of the South American artifacts as well.
And history of astronomy is full of unique and intelligent, gifted individuals. If you had to pick one as having made a special contribution to our understanding of the universe, who would that be?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because one thing that I've realised is that, again, something else came out of the research, that today research is done by teams, because basically it's based around technology. Very, very difficult to name one. When I was a student, a snotty-nosed little student, we all used to think that Fred Hoyle basically wrong. Steady-state theory. What's become apparent to me is that Fred was a maverick who really drove things. For example, he was so wedded to his steady-state theory, he had to actually work out where the heavier elements came from. So he got his team together, Burbage, Fowler and Hoyle, otherwise known as B-squared FH. The team worked out how stars generated heavier elements through nuclear synthesis. I look back on my skepticism of him, and I think I was a horrible, snotty-nosed little thing, and I really admire Fred. I want to come up with another. One person I was privileged to know very, very well was Stanley Hay, H-E-Y, and he was the person who discovered radio waves from the sun in 1942, that he was part of a team that was, they were basically doing radar on German warplanes, and suddenly a blocking signal came in at exactly the same frequency as their radar and blocked their signal, and everybody thought, it's a German death ray or something like that. And Stanley was cool and calm and collected and said, I'll work this one out. And he worked out that actually it was the sun, the sunspots that were blocking their radar. And he went on to found the first radio astronomy, proper radio astronomy observatory in Britain at the Royal Radar Establishment in Malvern. Bernard Lovell came down to him and said, hello, my dear Hay, can you bring your equipment up to Jodrell Bank? And as a result, Jodrell Bank was founded. So he died about 5 years ago, age 90. And I think probably one of the greatest scientists of the 20th century, and yet nobody knows about him.
Well, they will after today. Despite the access that professional and amateur astronomers have these days to CCD cameras, optical filters, huge aperture telescopes, we do have the light-polluted industrial skies here. Have we, living in our societies like this, lost the magic of the night sky that inspired earlier human societies?
I do strongly believe that we have lost the touch with the night sky. One of the saddest things I think I once wrote was, if light pollution continues like this, the only access that people will have to the night sky is by going to a planetarium. One thing I'm delighted about my village where I live is the villagers have actually opted out of having streetlights. But, you know, that's not true for a city like, for example, Manchester or London. We don't relate to the night sky the way we did. I do find that when people go on holiday, especially in August, they go to France and places like that, and they phone me up afterwards and say, Heather, I was amazed in beginning of August. I saw all these shooting stars. What I do interviews on radio and television is to say, if you're going on holiday in August and you're going somewhere dark, just take a look at the sky and you might see a little sort of fireworks display. And, you know, they do, and they come back to me and they write me little letters. And so maybe that's the thing to do, just here, you know, to look to unlight-polluted places.
And it is so refreshing when you hear somebody say that they've seen the Milky Way in all its glory during the holiday.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Milky Way in all its glory, I should never forget lying down when I was at the Siding Spring Observatory in the Warrumbungle Mountains range, and just literally lying on the road, in the middle of the road, wary of the fact that a bull kangaroo might come and jump on me. I could see the Milky Way literally stretching from horizon to horizon, and there's nothing like that, is there?
In your research or during your travels in the making of Cosmic Quest, did you have any sense of the role of amateur astronomers geographically around the world or through the ages?
We didn't cover the role of amateur astronomers per se in Cosmic Quest. What I have been very, very aware of is just how much amateurs have contributed. It's been amazing. You know, when I look at the Journal of the British Astronomical Association, I'm actually quite stunned, to be honest, because it's actually more technical than the journal that's put out by the Royal Astronomical Society, which is meant to be the journal for professionals. And the technical accuracy and observational experience of the observers in the BAA is quite phenomenal. And now, with fantastic equipment that the amateurs have, some of the images they can get are equivalent to professional images, and some of the measurements they're making are equivalent to professionals. But there is a terrific interest.
On a broader picture now, has the tradition of amateur astronomy, however you might define that, always been a part of human history?
Oh, I think amateur astronomy has always been very much a part of our history. I mean, when you think you would have farmers who'd go out and look at, for example, the rising of the Pleiades, and they wouldn't be professional astronomers or anything like that. They'd be using the sky to say, ah, it's beginning of autumn, this is when I start my ploughing. And I think the word amateur is a very good one here, because it doesn't mean that you're someone who isn't good enough to be a professional. It means that you are an amateur. You are someone who is in love with your subject.
When is the first episode of Cosmic Quest, and can you give us a flavour of its content?
On the 26th of May, which is bank holiday, about an hour after the afternoon play. So, you know, I know who the audience is going to be. So 3:45, 26th of May. What I'm doing in the first programme, well, this really fits the pattern of all the programmes. We're having specially composed music for every programme, which will fit with the period. and we've got actors to read the astronomers or what have you. In this programme, say for example, I start with a quote by an actor saying, from Isaac Newton, "If I have seen further than certain other men, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." And I carry on, "So wrote Isaac Newton to his fellow scientist Robert Hooke on February the 5th, 1675. And I carry on. In one stroke, Newton summarised the whole history of astronomy. "It is an edifice built on the endeavours of countless men and women throughout the millennia, a vast pyramid of human achievement that points towards the sky." So really, it's setting the scene. It's saying that the history of astronomy is more than a history of a science. It's an edifice, and it's built on human ideas and ideals. First five programmes of the first week are all basically before the dawn of science, and then the second week we go into the Greeks, two programmes on the Greeks. And I think there have been three revolutions in astronomy. There's been the Greeks, Copernicus kick-started the next one, and I think the person who kick-started the next one, the one we're living through, was my beloved Stanley Hay, who basically introduced us to multi-wavelength astronomy. I mean, how looking at an object, say, in X-rays and gamma rays and ultraviolet light, infrared and radio waves, can actually tell you about the different physics of the object. You know, for me, it's been the most fantastic revolution I could ever have wanted to have lived through. It's been amazing. And we'll be covering that in the programmes.
Just one of the many fascinating topics you'll be talking about. So it all starts on Monday the 26th.
That's right.
For 6 weeks daily, and then omnibus edition on a Friday, 9 p.m.
That's right. I mean, I'm really excited about the omnibus edition because 9 o'clock we get the compilation in omnibus, so we get a totally different audience. Astronomy has now been taken much more seriously by the media.
Just on the coincidence of dates, the first episode goes out on the 26th. On the 25th, the NASA spacecraft to Mars, Phoenix, is due to land on Mars. And it will have the first opportunity to do some experiments to look for life since the mid-70s,
yes.
The Viking. How do you rate its chances?
I rate its chances very highly, because I believe that we have discovered life on Mars already. It's one of the things that happened. Nigel Henderson and I wrote a book on Mars called Mars, the Inside Story of the Red Planet. And again, we went all over the States and we interviewed people, and we interviewed people who didn't want to be interviewed, but we winkled them out, including Gil Levine, who was in charge of the labelled release experiment on Viking. What happened when the Viking space probe landed? You had this little laboratory about the size of a microwave oven. You actually scooped up the Martian soil, fed it basically sugar, waited for the reaction, a bit of water in, and it basically like a baby burping. It gave off gas, and the gas appeared to be organic. And, you know, he was looking for bacteria, and he'd found these bacteria in air conditioning systems, and he found exactly the same curve coming from what looked like bacteria on Mars. I have to say that Nigel was extremely skeptical of Gil's results until we were in Gil's office in Washington, and I saw Nigel's face. And we think Gil discovered very primitive life. You know, we're talking about microbacteria on Mars. I think it's been found, and I think Phoenix will actually find something.
But the official results of Viking were, I think, inconclusive. That's the quote that usually used. If Phoenix does find something during the run of Cosmic Quest, do you anticipate updating the final episode of Cosmic Quest as a result?
We could do. The last program on Cosmic Quest is about the search for life. And, you know, if anything does happen, we will update accordingly, definitely. I mean, I think we will have to. So we'll have to see how that one goes. That's an interesting point. But if there is a newsflash that they have found bacteria, then believe me, I'll bring the program up to date. I shall overrule all my producers and tell them that we got the new premises.
Heather, I really look forward to listening all about the fascinating astronomy of the past and the exciting things yet to come. Heather Cooper, CBE. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabir.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. ATUK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on ATUK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.